Everybody on board with the little thing up? All right, great. So, that's the phone number. We just give Galaxy numbers and big catalog. It's called the Uppsala catalog of Galaxy. The Galaxy catalog is made in Sweden, and they just numbered everything. And honestly, that's how it is all. So, occasionally, we sort of unofficially give a Galaxy a name, or I name it after somebody. And so we named it after Vera Rubin, and I'll talk to you guys who Vera Rubin was and why we think that's an awesome person. Now, this is sort of my starting slide, and the thing that I want you to take away is that it sounds like I'm doing all the work, and then there's this whole crowd down here who I've been collaborating with. So you typically get stories of signs that, oh yeah, this hero person did all the work. Quite the opposite. It's always a team, and if they don't show it, hiding behind a pillar somewhere. So, if you want to catch it later, then, you know, use that to contact me. Yeah? No? Okay, we just skip forward 5 slides just because we can, I guess. So, here's our motivation why we do a study like this, right? So, I'm going to talk about just one galaxy. So, usually we don't study a galaxy, just one, there's so many around, right? So, but in this case, we know already from studying many galaxies that galaxies have a violent history. So if you want to make a big galaxy, it's usually a crash from many put together. And so, you see that they have either streams of stuff around, there's some wreckage around, lying around, that's the kind of thing that you see. And so, our motivation was that we saw this galaxy, we were curious if this was also, because it's a big one, whether or not it actually formed in the same way, or if it was, there's a different way to make a distinct being this galaxy. So, that starts with a movie. Start playing. Okay, so, we're talking just now, and somebody said, oh, everything I've heard about dark matter, this is the Big Bang Theory, and I'm like, well, guess what, astronomy is not much further ahead than the Big Bang Theory. We know it's there, there's some sort of stuff that does the gravity, and that's about it. We have a long list of things that isn't, but what it exactly is, we're still not clear on. What we do know is that it's there, it's sort of like some soupy gas, and so we put that in a computer, and then we put galaxies in there. And so the dark matter pulls everything in, pulls everything together, and as it keeps pulling in, the galaxies crash into each other. So this is how we know that if you make a really big galaxy, it's basically made up out of a car crash into a bunch of different points, right? So they all smash together. So that's what you expect there to happen. And so this is done in a computer because, you know, we'd like to speed things up, we'd like to know what's happening. And so it's called the Luskin simulation, because you need to have a good name, marketing is half the job, right? So you speed this up, you can see if I can find a time, there's no time on there, but this takes billions of years, but we don't have that kind of patience, so we run it in a computer and see what we end up with after a billion years. And you end up with a big orange blob. Okay, big orange blobs, we see big orange blobs all the time, they're called elliptical galaxies, and so what I'm going to show you is basically a galaxy that size, but it doesn't look like that. So maybe it is formed from, you know, 5, 6 different galaxies smashing together. But that's our motivation, right? So that's, if we think of like the biggest galaxies around, this is what we think of. Orange blobs, these are not, no blue, nothing new to see. Once again, a long list of people. This is like not even half the team. This is like the team lead. So, why did I call this after Vera Rubin, this galaxy? Well, this is Vera Rubin. As you can see from the pattern on the dress, she's there working in the 60s. She was one of the first women in astronomy that sort of had a very prominent role in the United States, especially on the California coast. So, she was one of the first people that noticed that the rotation, the way big galaxies rotate, can only be explained I think everybody I talk to has some kind of story how she chatted it to, you know, a young student, a young professor, basically at every level, and sort of said something that you went like, oh, cool, I want to keep going. So she was very encouraging. I have a story like that as well. I was just finishing up with my PhD. I was visiting a friend at her institute, and I had a chat with her, and she said, oh, yeah, let's think that you're studying. Edwin Hubble did the same thing. Here, I have a letter. Like, just showing how this guy kept me going for the rest of the, you know, finish my PhD kind of thing. So this is the kind of story. And I'm not the only story. Literally everybody I know has a Vera Rubin encouragement story. So we all sort of hope you discover dark matter. You're sort of an awesome person. Surely somebody's going to give you a Nobel Prize for all this, right? Yeah. We've sort of waited in vain up until 2016. No Nobel Prize, turned out to be wise. But when 2016 rolled around, it was like, okay, we need to do something else to sort of honor her. So that came, and the best link is just go to somebody, the kind of science that she did. So, Rubin and her supervisor, Ford, and this is Bob Mahalan and all the crowd, so this is like other people, two different teams, maybe. He found these points, they found these points, and if you go out, so here's the galaxy, and you go out further and further and further, and you look how fast the stars, so those are the yellow points, or the gas, and that's the blue points, is rotating. And if you look at it, you go like, okay, well, all the mass, like in our solar system, all the mass is sitting in our sun. Everything else is sort of like spare change. So it's 98% of all the stuff in the solar system is sun, and then there's 2% of everything else. So, if you look at that, then you expect that, you know, all the mass is going to give off light. It's going to be in the stars, right? So if you look at that and think of a galaxy like that, well, most of it's sitting here, there's hardly anything here. So this is what you expect from all the visible stuff, if all the mass is sitting in the stars. And this is what we see in the rotation. Like, there's a big gap here. And so you already see it in the stars, and then you see it as well in the galaxy. And that gap can only be explained if there's stuff here that isn't giving off light. And that's the dark matter. End of list of things we know what dark matter is, because, you know, it's there. And if you have a good idea what it could be, great, we're taking suggestions at this point. We haven't figured that out. So that was the strongest evidence that there was something extra there. And this is an extra one that I found her rotation versus getting further out, and this is how fast it's rotating. And yes, I think kilometers a second. I realize that kilometers are not that intuitive for everybody here. But you know, if you divide it by 1/2, this is not in miles per hour, this is in miles per second. So think of it as this stuff is rotating at about 200 miles per second. And we are as well right now, right? We're rotating around the center of our Milky Way. Nobody notices it because the sun, the whole solar system, everything is rotating with that kind of speed. But because space is so huge, you don't really notice it. The stars don't move, but they're also rotating with those kind of speed. But yes, the speeds are very, very high. I occasionally have to fill out, I don't know how fast I was driving, and on occasion I say accidentally kilometers per second, and people can look too funny. But yeah, so things rotate very, very quickly, and so Rubin and then the other teams. So they started comparing notes and found that they both found that the rotating galaxies were rotating that time. So I think that, like, there's two big science lessons to be had here. One, it's never a single person. Even with Vera Rubin, you know, we saw a second name there, right? And it's never a single observation. It's always like, this team found it, and that team found it, and the two agree. That's when it's actually good evidence. Because if you say, like, there's this invisible, non-light-up, non-normal stuff that keeps galaxies together, you kind of go, like, are you a little bit off your head, or did you partake a little bit too much downstairs? Because that's not good evidence, right? You need, for a bold claim, you need bold evidence. You need solid evidence. And one of those parts is when one team sees it with one telescope and another team on another continent with another completely different kind of telescope sees the same thing. That's where we're going, like, okay, cool, we're York, and there's a second paper, and this figure is in there. She talks about, you know, one of these got those rotation curves, like dark matter, and the other one was like, hey, I have this funny galaxy and it's really, really big. Because she has this, this is most of the paper, it's like, here is our Milky Way, the scale, and here's the rest of the sort of like, kind of galaxies that you can see with small telescopes. If you have like a, you know, tube like this, you can see the pinwheel galaxy pretty nicely and see the whole thing. M31 is always a favorite of Stevens. There are people who claim they can see it with the naked eye, and I do not believe them, but I'm also 45, so there you are. But M31 is right at the edge where you can tell it. It seems a little fuzzy, but you can see it with binoculars, with a pair of binoculars, right? So that's a great one. The M51, the Whirlpool, is always a fantastic one to go see. It's, you know, you can, I don't know, if you have an iPhone 13, you can probably take a picture with it now without any issue. But these are favorites for, you know, everybody's backyard astronomy. So we all kind of know these. They're all sort of this size, right? The Milky Way maybe a little bigger. And then you've got this whopper sitting there. And that was it. You know, this paper just sat there in the last 20 years ago. The last 42 years. There we are. So I noticed that Hubble has pretty much taken a good picture of all of those galaxies, because we all know them, we all love them, and you can all see all the cool detail. And we kind of forgot about this guy. And so 2016 is like, well, why wouldn't that be a great tribute to Vera Rubin, right? That seems like a perfect way to go. And so we did. So we took a picture of the whole thing. I had to add sprinkle some science on there as well, right? You can't just go like, I want to take three pictures. Although Hubble does that on occasion. This is the kind of thing where I go like, yeah, I could also really do a cool science with it, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But the main driver for me personally was, I want to do this because that seems like a nice thing to do. Now, this thing is 10 times the cost of our Milky Way. It is 1,000 billion some worth of mass, just in stars alone. So it's a million suns of mass. Now the Milky Way is like 100 million. 100 billion. Sorry, B versus M is always confusing me. Especially when I'm talking and thinking at the same time. So this thing is at least 10 times bigger, massive, and 5 times further across than our own Milky Way. How do you make a spiral galaxy that big, right? How do you get it? Because we just learned that in order to make a really big galaxy of that size, you need to smash a whole bunch of things together. And this looks fragile. This looks like it would, you know, you would smash it up. So we have no idea how you make something that whopping big with these lovely spiral arms. So these spiral arms are blue, and in the center it's red. That tells you something about the stars. The blue part is young stars. The blue star was very, very short for the stars. Even you would say it's probably very short. The biggest blue stars live for about 1,000 years. So it forms, run through all its fuel, explode. So if you see them, they must have formed pretty recently, because otherwise they would have, you know, left a burning corpse already. The yellow stuff is like our own sun. That's billions of years. They can turn along. So they could have formed, you know, a billion years ago and they'd still be there. But the blue ones are new. So this thing is making new stars, big spiral arms, very wispy. It's nice and symmetric. This guy over here is a star from our own Milky Way, sitting in the way. So I think that's actually the reason that we didn't take a picture of Hubble before, because we were scared that it's actually going to burn out the camera. But we figured out how to do that. a while ago, so we've taken pictures of all kinds of things, but it is kind of in the way and very annoying. And so, the kind of thing that you hope for is like you move it, you have to move it away a couple thousand years so that finally, you know, shifts out of the way. So, that's the thing that is about observational astronomy. You kind of go like, oh, this will be great. No, there's a thing in the way. There's usually a thing in the way, and there's usually a thing in the back as well. It's a windshield kind of size, right? You just get whatever you get. So, no Milky Way star, Milky Way star, Milky Way star, bunch of Milky Way stars, bunch of Milky Way stars, completely unrelated galaxy, just in the background for just for fun. And then all these little red stuff that is also a galaxy that are way further away, right? So these are like halfway across the universe. And that's sort of all this pile of information. And so we're going to go study why Milky Way does, and you can learn a little bit about how you would make a disk galaxy, rather than, you know, smashing a bunch of Milky Ways together. Yes, our theory is really well developed, smashing a bunch of stuff together, right? So, where is this? Well, they made a nice little video. The people from the Hubble Space Telescope are excellent at making little videos. So this is Percy. You see little, legs, I guess. So those are the visible stars. You can already see that there's a bunch of other stars that you wouldn't see unless you have a great camera or a telescope. And so you zoom on, so this is on the sky, these things are oozing patches, right? So you have to zoom. The reason that I wanted to show you this is that you go like, yeah, you can totally see it with a small telescope. I've actually had somebody from the Little Astronomical Society send me a picture, they're like, look, I got this from my backyard, and I'm like, fantastic. I also, it looks amazing, there's a lot of detail, but Hubble looks at a tiny spot on the sky. This took four shots with Hubble. It's pretty myopic, I think. There it is, yes. So you can take a small picture of a small part of the sky and then see a lot of detail. So, I think this is the same thing, but I've now flipped it around. So what can I learn from that? Oh, sorry, I wanted to show you that, yes, there's four pictures set together, and then we took pictures on the side as well, with the Hubble has two cameras, and you can use them at the same time. Now, personal goal and personal victory. When I started as an undergrad student, astronomy picture of the day was like the best thing on the internet. because it had a picture, it talked about the picture, the astronomy picture, and what I find incredible is that it still has that 1995 look to it. Right? It still has the same font, it still has, say, just like every other webpage in the universe is updated, and like nothing is in GeoCities anymore, and what have you. And these guys just go like, nope, this works. But every day there's like a new cool picture, and I was like, well, if I'm a grown-up astronomer, I will have my own astronomy picture of the day. So, cross that off the bucket list. That was awesome. Not only that, I got to present this picture at the American Astronomical Society meeting. That was really neat. Which was in Hawaii. Yeah, it did not suck. And this is sort of the people that are all working on this on various aspects. So we met the team at the thing, and not only that, the Space Telescope people had actually made this huge thing that we could all stand in front of. It was a little intimidating, like, oh, cool, yes, there it is. So that was very neat. They didn't let me take it with home, so that's unfortunate. But that's the kind of thing where you kind of look at these. You can use these pictures because they're free, or, I mean, even printed full on that full size, you can actually see a little bit. So how do you grow that, right? So you might as well map them bigger than a typical spiral galaxy, but, many times over. You can't smash them together. Mergers show, right? They show us stuff that's flying around, little loops. You kill all the star formations, so no more new blue stars. And so we look for the globular clusters. And so these are sort of the self-contained little worlds around the galaxy that are little blobs. There's a couple of really bright ones around our Milky Way. And they sort of form in one go, and then there's just this little blob of stars sitting there. And so you make one, you make two, and every galaxy has a residue of these things. They have a pocket. And so if you're a very big galaxy, you have a few of those, but if you're a small galaxy, you have relatively many more. You have sort of like a small galaxy has three, that's relatively way more than the Milky Way, that's 10 times bigger. So we were looking for those globular clusters, because if you make a galaxy that size out of lots of small galaxies, there should be loads of globular clusters. But if you make it out of, you know, just gently make it out of this one big galaxy, there should be a few clusters. So we can hopefully say something about how it makes. Now, just to give you an idea, this is the stellar mass, the 10 to the 12, that's million stellar masses, is right over here. This is where every other galaxy sits, and this is how much star formation is sitting actually pretty up. There's a special class of galaxies called super spirals, so I thought for the longest time that this would be a super spiral, right? Super spirals, that sounds like the class that I want. Except they all look like this. They all look like they just about narrowly escaped surviving a car crash, right? There's a second bit of galaxy here. This guy has no more spiral arms left because it's all mangled and what have you. And here's also clearly a second part that's, you know, swirling together. You can hold, you know, after the crash, fast pictures that I'm seeing. So, not so much, right? This is not a super spiral. It is another way to get there, another way to build big. So is this weird? Is this exception? I also look like, is this a normal size for it's still a mass? This is for all the galaxies. Yep, it's sitting. So this is the frustrating part. It's not being very exceptional in any other way other than it's just hulking masses sitting there in the corner. It's doing exactly what every other spiral galaxy does. Size and how fast it rotates. Exactly on that relation. Size and how many stars. Exactly on that list. There's nowhere where there's a little bit of deviation that's going like, oh, this point's this way. Like, nope, it's an extremely well-behaved giant sitting in the corner, just going like, I'm perfectly normal. They're not, right? So, is it rare? We kind of go, yes. Okay, I'm going to skip to these. So, what we found is that it's an SD galaxy. SD means that it has like a little tiny bulb in the center, and it's a massive disk. It is just huge. There are hardly any disk galaxies like that. If by the time you hit a thousand billion suns, it's always an elliptical. If I would tell you, like, hey, I've got a thousand billion suns worth of galaxy, they go like, cool, which elliptical is that, right? Nobody expects it. But it's relatively isolated. That's our first thing. So we found a whole bunch of young clusters. Those are these little blobs of blue in the spiral arm. We found a bunch of these globular clusters. And so we looked at how many, relatively speaking, do we see. They're all found in colors, found how bright they were. Yep, they're definitely globular clusters, is all you need to know from that. And we found a whole bunch of them that they're all consistent. This is how bright it is in magnitude. So I'm realizing that I'm now doing like this is a professional astronomer plot, and I think it's probably have to skip ahead. Where we're going with this. I looked at a bunch of other galaxies, so some of these names may sound familiar from that first plot with the Vera Rubin made, N61M101 were there, and N3M81 were there as well. So, how many of those things do I see and how dry are they? And so this is where Rubin sort of sits in the middle of all these very, 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 very normal spirals. So it's kind of like, okay, nothing special about the globular clusters. How many are there anyway? And so this is where I'm getting at with the Rubin's galaxy. This is a huge complicated plot. These are all the spirals, these are all the ellipticals. Sitting, you know, comfortable, this is how big it is, this is in, yeah, mass or luminosity. So bigger that way, how many of those globular clusters do I see? And there's a like a dip around here. If you make it, if you're a small spiral galaxy, you have a relative loss of them. If you're a huge whopping elliptical, you have a lot of them. And somewhere in the middle there's a dip, and our galaxy sits just below that dip. So it has a dearth of these globular clusters, hardly any. So it means it hasn't eaten any dwarf galaxies, any at all. It hasn't inherited any of these little blobs of stars that, you know, accompany a smaller galaxy, because if it would have crashed into this, the globular clusters would have stuck around. But we don't see them. So, whatever you do, you can't make this thing by crashing smaller galaxies together. Clearly it doesn't look like that. It's still forming stars. It doesn't look like a big yellow blob, and it doesn't have enough water to focus. What you can do is sort of drip, 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 drip. You give it a little bit of gas, a little bit of gas, just a little bit of gas. It turns it into stars. It just very gently forms forms over the last, I don't know, age of the universe. So no mergers, and so it looks like it's gradually growing. So what I'm thinking is sort of like a koi pond, right? Small pond, huge fish that just sat there very slowly, fed it every morning. Before you know it, it actually can't turn around anymore, but there it is. You've got your own personal whale. I have a second question though about small galaxies. Because if you have a galaxy that big, what often happens, or what always happens as far as we ever know, in the center of it is a supermassive black hole. So right at the beginning when everything forms, right when the dark matter sort of coalesces together, you get the very first stars, one of those stars explodes, becomes a dark, becomes a black hole. That black hole keeps just nibbling at everything around it. It does that for the age of the universe. You end up with a black hole that has a million solar masses. So you expect some huge black hole sitting in the center, and if there's something like that in the center, there's stuff falling in, you get a jet, you should see all kinds of activity in the center. This is happening here, because you may have seen the picture of the black hole that the that they took a few years ago, right? No, maybe not. It's okay. But we took a picture of a black hole. How awesome is that? It was a billion solar masses, right? So it's a very massive thing, but it's only the size of our solar system in another galaxy. My question here is, does this have any? Now, cool. We have a way to do that. We take a spectrum. Now, fortunately, somebody said, I don't know what a spectrum is, from out of the audience, and I would like to thank that person, because I totally went, everybody knows about it.
I don't know what a spectrum is.
Yeah. Well, no, I think that's a valid thing because I would have lost the audience and I don't want to do that. So I want to look at the center here, and a spectrum is a rainbow. I mean, really, we're just smearing out the light using a little, you know, a little triangle of glass. So the rainbow, that's droplet. So we're smearing out the light into its components of red, yellow, blue, green and blue and purple. Right? So we're smearing out and then looking at what's in there. So it's like, okay, cool, well, I'm sure there's these big surveys where we take a spectra of all these galaxies nearby. I'm sure there's a picture of that. I'm sure there's a spectrum. This is a huge galaxy. Of course somebody took a spectrum of that. I mean, that survey covers everything. So we need a spectrum, right? And I will get back to this. This is the only thing I want you to know about that, I'm realizing it. Every element has its own fingerprint. So I can tell from a spectrum if it's oxygen, I can tell if it's nitrogen, I can tell if it's carbon or anything else. So I can say, there's carbon in there, there's nitrogen in there. This is how we've learned about the chemistry of the universe, because we haven't been able to go there. That was, you know, we have the budget. So we kind of look at what kind of light comes off and then see the kind of elements in there. But also, those elements shine brighter and fainter depending on how hot it is around them. So if you're sitting next to how hot it is around them. So if they're in like a cool environment, we don't see them at all. If they're sitting next to a nice young hot star, they sort of, you know, glow to a certain degree. If they're sitting next to the inferno that is right next to a black hole, they're sort of screaming. So star forming, young new stars, that's the black hole. So I went over and went like, surely it's in the survey. Survey goes, sorry, I'll draw it out here. Survey ends here. Galaxy's over here. I was not happy. Because now I have to go out and get this data, and you know, wouldn't it have been nice if it was in the Atlas already? So, like a good modern astronomer, I moped about it on social media. And maybe I can see it. I got some guesses like, yeah, you should look at Wise, at the NASA satellite. Maybe that will tell you anything. Honestly, I'm not even going to bother explaining. This is the nucleus of this galaxy. It's supposed to be above that. It's a black hole. I have no idea. So I moved around, and the best part was that a colleague of mine, a friend of mine, basically went, well, I can give you one. I'm like, cool. Did you have your own survey? No. I have predicted one with a machine. So this is where we're going with astronomy. We predicted with something called machine learning. So if I don't have a spectrum, maybe I can predict it. And if anybody recognizes, this is the Marvin the Paranoid Android character from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and if you're sort of my age, you go like, oh, I know what that is, and if you're younger than me, you go, I have no clue what the sound is talking about. So, this is the kind of explanation that he sent to me, which, I'll be very honest, you thought I wouldn't get it, I don't get this either. What I understand is that he puts in pictures on one end, and the spectrum comes out. And in between here happens magic. It's not quite magic, I understand a little bit more, if he used smaller words, but I'm still going. He used a bunch of pictures that he had a spectrum for, and basically used that combination to predict one for us, based on their formation. This is what I'm expecting. Which is, I think, is a very neat trick. So, he showed me one more picture. It's like, look, this is the kind of galaxy that, and you know, the red and the black are, you know, right on top of each other. So prediction and the actual spectrum agree. So what he gave me was this black line. So this is a spectrum. So the spectrum is, here's wavelength, this is red, this is sort of yellow-green, this is super blue. And if there's equal amounts of color everywhere, then you have a flat line. And if there's a continual element in there, you see like these little spikes. So this kind of tells me that there's hydrogen in there. And, oh no, wait, that's opposite, sorry. I'm not a spectroscopist. So there's people who go like, oh yeah, there's my old friend Felicia, and I'm like, sure. So I'm an image guy, so there you are. But what you can see is that this is a black hole, that's the galaxy without any star forming happening, this is where new stars are. So hot stars, you know, the nice little neat little spike of supermassive black hole, that looks completely different. So we should see difference. What I'm seeing from the plus spectrum then predicted, right? Remember that his machine magic basically said this is what it should look like, and I'm like, okay, let's see. That it looks a little bit like an AGN, and it looks a little bit like a Giessen galaxy, and it has a little bit of star forming, but not a lot, right? It looks mostly like a, you know, very, very, very quiet AGN. Yes. Yeah.
So I think I, and of course I'm going to say I think I understand machine learning, and that's a ridiculous thing to say, but like I think I understand how it would be trained. Like, what would the input for the prediction be?
So
what are the inputs?
I told you that we had this huge survey of most of the northern sky. So you take the pictures of that, the spectra of that, and you say, okay, this picture belongs with this spectrum. You do that over and over and over again. You should say, okay, here's a new picture, I predict the spectrum.
Okay.
And that sort of...
It's a new raw picture.
It's a new raw picture,
yeah.
But you predicted the spectrum as a result.
Yeah.
It's sort of, you train the machine to go, if you see this picture, this is the color, the rainbow that should come out. And so you give it a new picture and goes, well, this is the rainbow you told me that would come out. So that's how I think it works. I don't want to go into it, but you know, yeah, there's a... Okay, so let's check. First, I have a collaborator called Bill Teal, who got out his spectra from 1983. Now, I was obsessed about space in 1983, but it must be in the form of Legos. You know, they should make the space Legos again. And then I asked nicely, so talking about like how science works, right? You need a team, you need two teams that agree, and you need a prediction. Hey, we have a prediction now, and so we can go check. And you can ask nicely, and I would not overstate how good it is to ask nicely in science, because the MMT is the multi-mirror 6-meter telescope. I didn't even have to go there. My friend Joanna and Stan basically went, okay, yeah, we have a half a night coming. So that's what we did, right? So Bill dug one out that I didn't exist in. Little sidebar, getting your data from 1983, can you imagine getting your data? What does that look like? Well, it looks like a paper printout. That's what I can tell you. He basically said, he took a picture with his phone, and he was like, here's the data from 1983. And I'm like, cool, here we go. So we took the MMC, virus keys, and other spectrographs, 16-inch and 18-0, those are two that Bill provided. So instead of zero spectra, I now have four spectra that I can compare to my machine learning. What do I call that, right? Marvin's prediction, right? So the black line is the prediction, the colored line are the spectra, so some of them don't go all the way. This one went all the way, but this one doesn't go all the way to the red. And the gray one is the one that we got special. They all agree. The machine was right on the money. So all the big spikes, the small spikes, everything was there. So that's really good. Good machine. Pat on the head, if you have one. It also, so this is again, how bright are my various molecules or atoms screaming, star forming. So the prediction was, just above it. The machine learning prediction was right. But yeah, it's definitely that. The green one is what we observed. I think that's because basically we're narrowing in on just the part that has the black hole. So this definitely has a supermassive black hole. It is just not incredibly loud. It's just very well hidden. It is not eating a lot of stuff, so being, loud and X-ray and all that. So, massive galaxy, low star formation. Next question is, if I build half a sun every year, and I keep at it for 13 billion years, oh yeah, that would work out. So, most galaxies are sort of deadline oriented, I would say. They sort of build their entire star system, all the stars, in like one all-nighter. And that's it, and then the rest of the time they're not very productive. Apparently Rubens Galaxy's just been quietly getting in the corner doing the whole thing the whole time. So I quite like it. It suggests that it's basically been feeding very Dirichlet valves of gas and not no big deals with other galaxies. And then the fun sort of like side project, because I whined about it on Twitter, was to look at the machine learning example, and so this could be Wu and Zeke, and so they took the pictures and then predicted it, and yeah, right on there, but there is an AGN in there, so hey, this does have a massive supermassive black hole, but apparently not screaming too loud, so I want to go look at that in a little more detail. So, I wouldn't be a proper astronomer if this would end with like, and now I'm done and I'm ready for a beer. I am ready for a beer, but I'm not done with this particular galaxy. We totally are going to every other telescope that we can find to look and learn more about this. And it's still so, one of the things that's interesting is, so that doesn't look like a normal telescope, it isn't. It's a radio telescope. We're going to go look at how much gas this thing has. How much gas in the tank does the galaxy that size have, right? So you think of the gas flowing in, that's the gas from the pump. Inside there's a bunch of gas, like that's the gas in the tank. And then, whatever's turning it into stars, that's the ignition. The Keck telescope, we're going to go look at that center of that galaxy. Tittel is another Hawaiian telescope. We're going to go look at how everything's moving in greater detail. This is the 2.7 in Texas that we're going to use in May. And then there's this guy, and as you can see, I'm slightly Lego obsessed. He's good. I use Lego telescopes for telescopes that don't really exist yet because I don't like using computer-generated pictures. But I have to use one. But this thing is launched. It's ready. It's good to go. And so we are totally going to ask if we can look at the center and look at that supermassive black hole. So there's a lot more in the future. But at this point, that's where we're at now. I have thought for 45 minutes is what I was aiming for, because then I have 15 minutes to discuss it for longer, whenever you would run out of them. So, yes, let me have it.
Thank you.
to move around. And I need to resolve that. So, yeah, welcome to, you know, the biggest telescope that somebody can irresponsibly give me access to. They don't let you drive that thing, by the way, right? You just go, like, look at that. And you go, like, don't touch anything. So that's basically the level. So that's the next step. How big is this thing, really? But I can see because there is a little bit of gas nearby, and it's sitting in a really hot environment, which is one of those accretion disks around the black hole. So it's looking like there is an environment that is around the black hole. So there is higher ionization state, which does make sense.
So would you say that there's less gas streaming, but you can still...
Yeah, there's less of it, but it is clearly in a very hot place right there in the center. So yeah, there's definitely a black hole shining on it. Any other questions? Cannot have been this clear, so everybody has to have a question.
I say we propose a toast to Vera Rubin.
Yay! The other team is two of those people were my supervisors for my PhD. So this is the kind of thing where you have one team and you grow up in one sort of scientific environment, go like, these people are awesome, and then you go meet Vera Rubin, like, this person is also awesome. And a lot of these people not get a Nobel Prize. That still feels criminal to me, but anyway. It's not about credit, right? Although, this is a nice cash bonus.
What did that mean about clerical on the previous?
Yes, so that's one of those things that we use it as one meaning, and in the rest of the world it has a different one, but it's sort of secular versus clerical, and it's like none of us wearing a patch. Well, actually, there are astronomers wearing a patch off, I should just forget that. But the secular means on your own, so the galaxy does that on its own, without any outside interference. And then there's environmental, which is sort of the like something, buzzes it, and it's like now the globe looks all discombobulated, right? So that's the thing that we're trying to figure out. This might be a great place to go see what happens if you just let a galaxy stick to its knitting for 13 billion years, and this is what you get. And everything else you need, in the environment. So that's the idea. So it would be an interesting little laboratory. Any other questions?
Yes. Are there any other potential candidates that exhibit the same characteristics that we know of yet, or no?
Well, I'm sure I can find another one, but it won't be as neatly nearby as this guy. You start anthropomorphizing galaxies a little bit. To the point that a colleague of mine said, every galaxy is weird as soon as you get to know them, just like people. That's about right. But this is close enough that you can see detail of bubble. I think the next one ever will be so far away that it's going to be a fuzzy little small thing. I'm sure there are others. But, you need a rare kind of empty space, nothing smashing into it. I understand here that somebody gives me a question.
I got it.
Yep, go
for it. On this dark matter issue, which I know nothing about.
Yeah,
it is. I mean, how come? In our solar system, we encountered it, or we don't know about it.
So what we think is that it does one thing, which is gravity, and nothing else. Which is very annoying if you're trying to learn everything from light, because it goes like, yeah, I'm not emitting light, I'm not absorbing light, I'm not scattering light, I'm doing nothing to light, really. So it's like, yeah, this has no effect. So it just does gravity. But we see the effect if we have a big blob of dark matter. We see, for example, the light fading away. So we see that happening, but there's nothing where, it changes the color of the light. That would help. It doesn't do anything like, it reacts with normal matter. It doesn't do that. There's neutrinos coming from our own sun. There's, billions of them floating through the room right now. We don't notice because it doesn't interact with normal matter, so we got to go like, all right, there you go. So it's hard to detect if it doesn't do anything except gravity. Annoying. Sorry, I'd like to know more about dark matter. We sort of listed all the normal weird particles. up to and including things like, oh, could it be like loads of asteroids, little Jupiters, or tiny black holes? Like, we've crossed some weird stuff off our list, right? We're down to the, is it all the paperwork in the universe kind of level. We don't know where we are. But it's probably going to be some weird new parts. So that's what we're hoping to find.
Yes. So for the machine learning algorithms that you use to like help predict a lot of the properties about Ruby's galaxy, how many like really like complete observations does it take to really like hone these algorithms to accurately predict things?
That was the thing that made me think like this is just magic, right? This is voodoo. Because it takes six pictures. So it is six different color pictures, so different colors, but it's six pieces of information where you can sort of see what the galaxy is made of. What weirded me out was that there wasn't a galaxy like that in the training set. So there wasn't a galaxy like that before, but it predicted it accurately, which is the part where I'm like, I don't know exactly what's happening here. It may have been two biases that came from each other. So that is, that's a job that's going on. So that's where we're at. It's sort of like the machine learning did a good job, and now we have to go sort of find a thread why it did a good job, because we kind of cannot figure out why. We just know it did, which is the part that I don't like, right? You want a complete chain of evidence as a scientist. You just want to like, we found this, and this is why, and this is this, and this is this. So we're trying to find that the other way around. It basically comes, I'm happy to give you like a whole thing about what we figured out. We figured out that there's a whole bunch of these bigger spirals further away, and the spectrum actually takes a little bit, the bigger chunk out of it, and so it looks more like Vera Rubin's galaxy, where the spectrum is a smaller chunk. We think that's what, like, well, the plot that I showed you, like, that sort of points in that direction, but it is kind of encouraging that it's not just good for everything, right? So most of all of us deal with machine learning because Facebook just recognized us on the, you know, pictures of them. Right? So that's how machine learning usually works for us. It's kind of encouraging to think, maybe not, that it would also find the one friend that we only have one picture of, from 2003, and now we take a new picture and it goes, oh, that's Paul. And you go like, how do you know that, right? There's a bit of an uncanny valley there. Better than we thought. There you are. I'm ending on a bummer. That's not good. Yes.
Okay, so it kind of looks like machine learning is you throw some data into something and you get something good out the other end.
Yep.
Okay, so don't we like to take stuff apart? Is there a way to take apart?
Yep.
Maybe this information for you from people who take apart this, because in a sense, all of your plots are kind of that came out of that are kind of part of that, right?
Yep. So John does this for a living. So astronomy is loving the machine learning part for the following reason: you go to machine learning because the amount of data that you see sort of coming down at you, bearing down on you, is so much that you cannot deal with it with normal techniques. So it's the kind of thing where if somebody hands you a photo album, here, find all pictures of Aunt Betsy, and you go like, okay, cool, that will take me an hour. Here's more of like, here's a warehouse of all the pictures from people in Louisville. Can you find every one of them of Aunt Betsy? Like, that's the part that's like, this is going to take me a decade. Like, why are you giving me this job, right? So that's when you need a different tool. So that's why we're motivated to go to machine learning. The thing is, it also tells us what's the minimum amount of information that I need to learn about a new thing, right? So it turns out, six things tells me whether or not this has an AGN or not. That's way less than I thought I would have predicted. I would have said, like, no, I need a spectrum of this. No, that's all we need. So it can give you a good guess. It can find things for you, for example. Like, it can go into the next all-sky picture and tell you, here's your equivalent Rubin galaxy. Here's all 12 of them that are in the entire sky.
there's a few billion galaxies in there, but here's all 12 that you need. That's the kind of job that you don't want to give to a student to do for a summer, because they're still going to be at it a decade later. And so that's why we need tools like that, and that's why we're trying them out on something that we understand reasonably well, so we are not completely baffled what comes out of the machine later. But that's the idea. So, yeah.
To map where you showed this galaxy is just being outside the map, where did that mapping come from?
So it's called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Now, if you happen to have gone to a public restroom, you probably have seen the name Sloan on the day there. Sloan is a huge company, and one of the things they make is in the water closet. There's money in that, clearly, because they bankrolled, the Sloan family bankrolled, like, hey, why don't you guys make a whole or digital picture of North America? So, for the longest time, everything that we learned about the whole sky was based on photographic plates. So these were like these big glass plates that we actually developed in chemical glass. That was such a lot of effort that was the picture of the sky that we had. And then CCDs came along, digital cameras came along. It really became clear that we should really think about making possibly a digital picture of the sky, right? So that was going to be expensive. We needed money for that. So we're slow and people. Okay, so the Sloan Foundation funded that, but they did a third of the whole sky, so about most of the northern sky. So they have to stop at one point. They stopped just short of. We're filling in the rest now, but it is the kind of thing where you go like, surely this, Rubin saw this in the '60s. This is going to be in there, and then after they go over to the website and like, nope. There's a little funny sound. So, any other questions? Everybody's scratching their neck and all sort of jumping out of the rooms and crowds as well.
Just one else has one. I have two parts. Number one, just on the question back there. So, you put six different colors in, but your training set is not the size of the training set. The size of the training set?
The size of the training set. So, machines don't get bored, so you can, instead of, you know how you learn how to do shapes and colors with a block, and it's like, and you learn it after six times, and even a toddler is bored after that about half an hour? This is like, here is a quarter of a million objects, and so,
that makes a lot of sense.
So, there's also a reason that if that is the kind of thing that you're getting into a computer, it's no longer the kind of thing that you can do on your laptop. You can melt your laptop. So, this goes into the bigger machines that
Second part that I realized we should have talked about this already. When I look at Rubin's galaxy, it reminds me of another galaxy I am very fascinated with, which is Marlin 1.
Yes.
Marlin 1 being one of the largest globes of this horizon, but actually one of the largest galaxies in the universe, like Rubin's galaxy.
Similar size and diameter.
Yeah. So, my question is, what do you think, can you relate these two, with Rubin's galaxy in principle being the future of Marlin 1? So that Marlin 1, as a low surface horizon galaxy, forms almost no salt, but it has a huge reservoir of gas, so it has the potential to form salt.
Yeah, but it doesn't for some reason.
It looks like, the star forming rates are, I would say, almost similar. Half a mile per year.
Okay.
Pretty low.
So it turns out that you have a giant banner of your galaxy that's a bit of a complication. So at the conference, I got chatting to David Young, who studies low surface rate galaxies. So he was like, this is like Marlin 1. And I'm like, no, because this one actually is doing some work, right? It is forming some galaxies. It is forming new stars. So, but they're about the same size. They're very similar in total mass. So what's different? So if we are studying, he's got a larger study. We're studying. You can't study trying to study mainly one, but always something sort of similar. So we're trying to figure out, because he's convinced that this is right on the edge of what we call idealism, right? But it's not. It's a normal galaxy. If I told you this is like the size of our Milky Way, we were going like, it's like it's 5 times. But it's very similar in size and it's a big disk, and so this is sort of like successful mailing. So that's how I think of it.
For me, it almost looks like this is what mailing one will become in a billion or 2 years. Because
if it ever gets around to, you know,
yeah, the history seems to be so similar. You have it sitting there isolated, doing its own thing, and has used this huge gas reservoir. That's all what you find in Mali number 2.
Also has a huge gas reservoir. This thing can probably keep trucking for you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So it might just have a little bit higher density, so therefore forming
I agree. This will
a
be
few more stars.
We have a couple of these other like low surface planets to compare to.
Which would then get me back to some ideas where you have these kinds of galaxies being formed in the beginning of in the universe in lower density regions and then just sitting there,
so
evolving without a lot of interaction or non-interaction at all.
The early universe is anything but a quiet, restful place.
Yes, I know.
It is very full of other things moving around, and so usually crashes into something. I think this has been sitting, just happened to find itself in a quiet corner, and it's sitting there.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. So when we see all these large, giant, those surprises coming,
maybe what
I'm thinking could become out of that.
Jason and I will figure this out too. We're working on that on the McDonald's Observatory. Cool.
Have you characterized the dark matter profile of this one yet?
Nope. Vera Rubin did a perfect job. No, I don't have to, right? There's three different studies that have done that. There's more recent ones, which is typically in every long and or dark matter study. So it's like, this has already been observed that was it. I do not need to be able to do that. Everything else, sure. But
yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm going to riff on that and an earlier question, and I'm going to make a comment on something that's probably broader than you want to talk about. But so is dark matter everywhere? Is it just sort of like hanging out with regular matter in roughly equal proportions, such that everything kind of looks like what it does, but with extra gravity, or
the first thing we actually, one of the thoughts that we had as soon as those rotation curves came back was like, oh, did we get gravity wrong again? because it's a logical thought process, because first we had Newton, and that turned out to be wrong close to big, heavy things, and that gave us Einstein's general relativity. So maybe on very large scale, very far away, we get this wrong. The trouble is that it has to scale again with the luminous stuff, right? The actual normal matter. And so if we do that, it should scale across all these galaxies. The neat thing is the galaxies, they look the same, and they sort of act the same, but it's orders of magnitude, like steps of 10, right? So you have about 6 steps of 10 from the smallest galaxy to the biggest galaxy. Biggest one being this guy. So, and they all rotate the same way. They all rotate like that, and so you're like, yeah, it should be a much bigger effect in the big galaxy than the small galaxy. So it's like, yeah, they all have a bunch of dark matter. And yeah, it's all there. The other thing is that we have a hard time making galaxies in the very, 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 very beginning from the computer. Right after the Big Bang, everything is super smooth. How do you get everything to start coalescing, right? So that first gibbet, that bit of gravity that pulls everything together, you sort of need dark matter for that. So we need dark matter, we don't know what it is. So our science is doing great. We have big mysteries still to deal with, so that's fine. You had a second for comment.
No, I think it was just more like, you know, so I'm coming from like a particle physics background, and I always, and it's like I want to understand everything, of course. I think astros are coming out the other direction, right? And I've always just been like well, how? Like, I get that we need dark matter. We need it. Like, what kind of character does it have? And I've always been
roughly distributed where you see the galaxy. So it's like there's like this blob of dark matter, and that's sort of the galaxy fell in them later.
Okay.
So that's how it works. But yeah, there's a lot of it.
So on the original spectrograph you had, where there, you had machine learning prediction, there was a noticeable lack of a peak around 5,000 angstrom-ish.
That is the.
But it was present in the ocean.
Is one of the big oxygen lines.
Right.
Yes. And that's
right.
Where so that typically happens in around October.
Okay.
So that's where you expect that big peak, but in AVN you depends a little bit on how much everything is bumped. It's also that everything is a little broader, right? So these are fatter lines. So that's two predictions that I have.
Okay.
I still think it did an amazing, the little machine did an amazing job, but it would be interesting to see if it predicts other things as well. Incredibly slowly, because this is the next molecule is, you know,